from 90.1 WFYI Public Radio. Welcome to The Art of the Matter, made possible by the ongoing support from listeners like you. And from the Palladium at the Center for the Performing Arts, opening in January 2011.
Hello and welcome to The Art of the Matter. I'm Travis DiNicola. The music for today's show is courtesy of the Baselli Walrab Jazz Orchestra from their Heart and Soul album, available through Owl Studios at owlstudios.com.
And I'm Sharon Gamble. Today I'll meet some local queens of contra dancing.
And I'll find out about a new arts project that Big Car Gallery is bringing to Indianapolis neighborhoods.
I'll talk with Rusty Moe about his new book, Bright Wild Stone. Plus, we'll have our arts calendar we call
What'll We Do? All that and more right after the latest news from NPR. If you heard the All Things Considered story about contra dancing this summer, and you were intrigued by an interviewee's description of a swirl of awesomeness, well, Juliet Port and Diana Davis want to meet you. Sharon Gamble invited these local queens of contra dance into our studio to learn about the indie contra dance scene and about Gypsy Moon Ball, a mega contra dance event, November 5th through the 7th.
My name's Juliet Port, and I actually grew up contra dancing in Bloomington.
Really?
My parents did it starting in the 80s.
And I'm Diana Davis, and I am on the opposite side of the spectrum. Juliet actually got me into contra dancing about a year and a half ago. She kept on talking and talking about it, and I was like, finally, all right, I'll go check it out.
Shut up.
And, yeah. and I went, and then I fell in love with it. It was so much fun. So
I know that some of our listeners will be familiar because there was a big piece by at the national level on NPR recently about contra dancing and how it was catching on, especially among younger people. Yes. But how would you define it?
Contra dance is a fun community dance where everyone involved gets to dance together in long lines you have a partner and you do a series of moves with people up and down the lines. When we say community dance, we say that because everyone's invited. Beginners are always welcome. We teach every dance, and there's no performance or competition style of this dance. So it's really just about having fun and getting together with people. And it's not, there's no right or wrong or some kind of judgment or performance that's happening.
And it's always done to live music, which is a little more unique for dancing. So there's always a live band, and it alternates every week. And the styles go from Irish music to old time to French Canadian to newer, recently written music that might have like a rock edge, or it might have, you know, something with percussion, or it just depends on the band. Every week is different, so it's fun. And so you're dancing to that with a partner, and So, every dance is different, but you don't have to know how to do it, which is fun. So,
and at each of your events, and you don't have to bring a partner. You can come by yourself because you'll end up dancing with pretty much
everybody.
Yeah, you switch partners every dance, and it's very open. People ask people to dance. Guys ask girls. Girls ask guys. Girls ask girls. It's kind of a gender free dance. Typically, it's guys and girls dancing together, but it's very open.
You might have a night when 50 women and 10 men show up.
Exactly.
So.
Yeah.
Hopefully not very often, but,
yeah.
But we all like dancing with each other and switching genders. Once you get used to the dance, it's kind of fun to do that too. So sometimes I dance as a man just for fun.
It feels like, you know, in doing a little research on this, I read that lots of times people like to dance the opposite, quote unquote, the opposite gender's role just for the challenge.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah.
It feels like contra dance is filling a niche that used to be filled back in the day when your parents, grandparents, great-grandparents all came up through school. And I don't think this died out until maybe the 80s or even 90s. Most communities had at least one little old lady who taught ballroom dancing.
Right.
And everybody around 7th or 8th grade went there, and there was a big, you know, dance where they could show off their skills at the end of the classes. But almost nobody ballroom dances anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And this feels like a wonderful, generous, not substitution, but maybe a next evolutionary step in that, because you don't have to worry about, you know, I'm not dating anybody who dances, so I can't go.
Well, and I think the ballroom dances, too, they're fun. A lot, they're getting popularity with some of the TV shows about ballroom.
Sure.
But there's a lot of pressure on the man to, it's really, you're dependent on the leader, the lead part knowing the right move and knowing how many moves that person knows depends on how much, you know, how much fun you have. Whereas in Contra, there's not a lot of pressure because every dance is taught. You're being told what to do. You can do additional things on top of the basic step. So the experienced people have a lot of fun adding craziness to the basic step. But the beginners can just, especially the beginning lead dancers, can just follow the instructions. So everybody has fun from the beginner to the experienced person. So it's not about how good you are. It's just about having fun.
It feels like, and I know there's some dispute about exactly whether it was the English or the French who invented it, and, you know, I think one explanation I read, tell me if you've heard this or if this holds any water for you, was that the English invented it, but the French named it Contra Dance and claimed they invented it and so forth.
If you look online, there's a lot of different theories on where it came from. What I really see in Contra is that it's a living folk tradition. It evolved. All these different immigrants came to this country with different styles of dance and different instruments, and some of the instruments like banjo even go back to African roots, you know, and there were different set dances in all the different cultures in Europe, and they came to America, and it's really just evolved as a living folk tradition from that. We're not trying to reenact the old-time dances that were done 30, 50, 80 years ago. Every once in a while we'll do an old dance, but most of the dances we do now were actually written in the last 10, 15 years.
So new steps are still being created.
Yeah, there's new dances written all the time, and a lot of the callers write their own dances, and the styles of what's popular and different moves have gained popularity, and so it's really a living tradition. It has its roots in European set dances, but it's become an American tradition that has, you know, waned and waxed popularity over time, but it's a living folk tradition.
Is there some kind of organic or historical relationship with square dancing?
Absolutely.
Definitely. And some squares are still called at contra dances sometimes, and a lot of the similar moves are used. It's just a different style, and some people like them, some people don't like them, but it, you know, you just have fun, and it just depends on the caller. And
but there's a caller for every dance.
Yeah.
Yes.
And we do do-si-dos and swing your partner, and so if you did square dancing, if you've had experience with that, maybe you did it in elementary
school or something,
you'll have familiarity with a lot of the moves that we do.
Yeah.
So walk us through, somebody listening to this is going to go, well, that sounds like fun, I'm going to try it out. Walk us through, you know, what should they wear, what should they do when they get there. There's probably an introductory session or kind of a beginner's, a novice orientation.
Yep. We have, we encourage people to just dress cool and comfortable. It is aerobic, so the greatest mistake people do is wear too many clothes. So, you know, dress in layers and wear comfortable shoes. If they have a little slide to them, that'll be easier on your joints. But we have an introductory dance every week at 7:40. We do an introduction that's not required, but we encourage new people to show up, and you'll learn some of the moves and a little bit of what will happen.
Where in the building does this happen?
This is in the Earth House at the corner of New York and East Street, and we're upstairs at the top of the Earth House every Tuesday at 8 o'clock. So we have an introduction, and then every dance is called, and there's always live music. We tend to do easier dances in the beginning, so we encourage people to come early, and then you'll build through your complexity throughout the dance.
And if somebody gets there and it gets a little complex and they go, ooh, I don't think I can keep up, is it okay to just stand and watch?
Of course. And some people like to just listen to the music, too, and watch the dancers. But you get better by doing it as opposed to watching it. So, since every dance is taught, and it might seem hard in the instruction when you're learning it, but the dance is only 64 beats long, and then you repeat it over and over again with different people. So even if it seems a little confusing in the beginning, you're going to do it like 10, 15, 20 times, so you'll get better at it as you go along, and it'll become more fun as it gets easier and everything.
And people are pretty generous. The more experienced dancers
are pretty kind
to the beginners.
Yes. We have new people every week. We enjoy having new people. It is fun for everybody, and we're all used to helping the new people figure out what to do, and so
And we want to have new dancers. We want to build our community. So we always encourage our older dancers to dance with the newer dancers and help them out. And it really, in that way, it is a special community because everyone wants everyone to succeed. And it's not about competition or being the best dancer. It's just about having fun. So
Help us with terminology. What do you call, let's say we come in and the band is going to play a Virginia reel. Mm-hmm. Is there a name for the specific dance? Would you call that this whole 64 beats is going to be a reel or?
All the dances have their own names. The dances and the songs are not linked necessarily. So the band and the caller may be in cahoots to make things more fun. But in general, you know, it's not one dance goes with one song. So people don't have the dances memorized. Everybody in the room is learning every dance. There are hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of contra dances. The callers don't even have them memorized. They have cards. Most of the dances were written by somebody, and they'll announce that. But it's not like you're walking into a room where everyone knows the dance except you. Actually, no one knows the dance. We all need to be taught. Some people are more familiar and have more experience, and they'll pick it up quicker, but that's why they're there to help everybody. But we're all learning it every time.
Are there regional styles in Contra? Is there like a Midwest style versus maybe if you took a trip to Atlanta and went to an event?
Especially with the Internet and it's becoming more popular, I think at the most I'd say the music might be more regional, but even that is changing. I think Indiana used to be more traditional, like old-time. You might call it like bluegrass-ish music if you don't know old time, but even that's changing. I mean, I play my clarinet to this kind of music, and I have a band with a drummer, so that is changing too, and it's evolving, and people are becoming more sensitive to the music, I think, and they want a really high, excellent, quality music, and so more bands are listening to different bands and adding different kinds of styles, and but overall, I think if you dance anywhere in the country, it's not going to be hard to fit in, or you're not going to hear anything real particular. It's just, everyone's learning from each other.
You both dance, but you both also play in bands that play for these dances. Let's talk about you play in two different bands. Let's talk about you've shared before we turned on the microphones, clarinet, accordion, and
piano.
Piano?
Yes. So I play in multiple bands. I kind of got addicted to it, and so. it's so much fun to play. So I have a band called the Coffee Zombies, which is a tune written by our fiddle player in Louisville called the Coffee Zombies. So that band is made up of fiddle. I play piano and drums, but he also plays guitar, and I also play clarinet. So we also do swing songs where we switch off instruments. And we travel around the Midwest playing at different country dances. And then I also have a band with Juliet called the Spinels, because she really wanted to do an all-girl band, because there's still a lot of just male bands in the contra community. So we wanted to have an all-girl band, and then we play together on that, where Juliet plays the bass. And we do all kinds of different styles of music, and we play around the area, play a lot in Indianapolis, so it's a lot of fun.
Where in the country? I mean, obviously, this scene has been really heating up in Indianapolis, largely due to your and your colleagues' efforts. But where else is this becoming like the hot thing to do?
It's really been big and growing in the New England states for over the last 15 years. It's really taken off with a lot of big, huge dances out there every week. They have hundreds of dancers. The Mid-Atlantic states, it's huge. Appalachia, South Carolina, and Asheville and Greenville, South Carolina, it's really big. It's also big in the Northwest, Portland and Seattle. There's big scenes out there. The Midwest has a pretty big scene. This weekend we're heading down to Bloomington. There's a dance where there'll probably be about 400 dancers.
Wow.
That dance has been going on, though, I've been going there since 1984. I think the first dance was 1970-something of that. That's called Sugar Hill. So we have big regional dances here in the Midwest where there's hundreds of dancers on the weekends that come. So and people travel pretty far to go to big dances.
Yeah.
So it's a growing community dance that's happening all over the country, really.
And in fact, you're hosting a big event in early November. And what is it called? Remind me.
It's called Gypsy Moon Ball, and it's November 5th through 7th. And it is actually a costume dance weekend. We're on
really?
Saturday night. You get to dress up, and if you want, and there's a costume contest. And it's a full weekend of dancing, so Friday night, Saturday afternoon, evening, and Sunday afternoon, there'll be contra dancing and couples dancing and waltzing, and it's a lot of fun, and yeah, we host it here in Indianapolis, and we're going to be this year at the, Juliet, remind me.
Friday night is at the Zion Evangelical Church downtown in Indianapolis, and that's near the Marais in Alabama. And then we have Saturday and Sunday is at Camp Belzer Boy Scout Camp, which is over on Boy Scout Road near 56 and Shadeland.
And you're a lot of people, several hundred people?
Several hundred.
Several whole people. And my Coffee Zombie Band is playing. And we also have Perpetual Emotion playing, which is one of the bands that was featured on the national program on the contra dancing. So we're really excited about that.
Yeah, they're an example of a new band that's playing new styles of bringing new styles of music and loop recordings to contra dance, and there are two young guys playing, doing amazing things with fiddles, didgeridoos, and electronic loops, and all kinds of amazing things
really
with foot percussion. And they're a lot of fun. So we're excited that we were able to get them and sign them on to our little dance here in Indiana.
Sharon Gamble with Juliet Port and Diana Davis. Find out more about the Gypsy Moon Ball, a mega contra dance event from November 5th through the 7th at indycontra.org. That's IndyContra.org. You can also learn about weekly contra dance events at the site, and here's a sample of the kind of music that you just might want to dance to.
Listening to The Art of the Matter on WFYI 90.1 FM Public Radio. This fall, the Fountain Square Arts Organization Big Car will put on six made-for-each-other community art events in six different neighborhoods. This project is the result of an Imagine Big grant that Big Car received from the Great Indy Neighborhood Initiative. Travis DiNicola spoke with Big Car's community art coordinator, Jim Walker, as well as Lori Miles, an art professor from DePauw, about the events, including the Test Fest environmental installation show taking place from 10 to 4 this Saturday, October 16th.
Jim, Big Car's just doing, it seems, more stuff all the time. It's hard to keep track of it. Congratulations with the continued growth you guys are experiencing. This is a pretty cool project you're working on, the whole Made for Each Other, which actually is engaging so many different neighborhoods. And I know there was a big grant through Ginny, the Great Indy Neighborhood Initiative. Tell me about sort of how this all came to be, and then we'll talk about some of the specific projects that are going on.
Okay, so in 2009, we applied for a grant. Ginny has it's an initiative to help neighborhoods through different projects, and some of them are community-based, just projects like maybe putting in a neighborhood garden or working on sidewalks or doing an educational program or something like that. And most of the grants are $5,000. They've been doing those for a number of years. And they came out with a new one that was $50,000, and we applied for that. And our application was to do eight different projects around the city in different neighborhoods, all using art ideas and initiatives to kind of make a difference in each of these neighborhoods.
That's a great vision, I think, that you guys had to go and, you know, and to tackle something this big. Is this the biggest grant that Artbox has received? Or?
You mean Big Car?
God, I did it again. And back in 3, 2, 1. Is this the biggest grant that Big Car has received before?
Yes. Yeah. $50,000. And the thing about this grant that's interesting and challenging is that all the money goes to the projects, and none of it goes to staff.
So no overhead or things like that?
No. And so we're putting in our time basically finding volunteers, working within our, what we were already going to do in terms of funding that we had. And
that's pretty tough to do, though. I mean, in all honesty, to take on a project without, you know, essentially, you know, taking in the overhead expenses, because you guys, you know, are still running Big Car, and there's, you know, certainly expenses, you know, associated with that.
Yeah, we kind of feel like Oprah. So we're just like, you know, giving away money, and because, you know, it's got to go, and it's nice in some ways, but in other ways it's a challenge. But our plan is to continue doing this afterwards and figure out ways to, you know, find funding to keep it going And keep doing these kind of projects around the city.
Sure, and certainly it brings more attention to Big Car and the work you're doing down there in Fountain Square. Briefly, for people who may not be familiar with Big Car, it's a gallery, but it's so much more.
Right, Big Car is our thing is about making things happen in the city and doing things that make the city a better place, and using art and creative ideas to kind of make that stuff happen when it might not otherwise.
Well, some of the events already have started for the Made for Each Other, including, I know there was like a dance performance with Susurrus over at the Mary Rigg Neighborhood Center, and there's been some other things that have been going on. One of the ones that's going on, in fact, the weekend that we're airing this interview, is Test Fest, an environmental installation show, and this is where, Lori, you come into the picture
right
here. I was telling you earlier, when Jim first described it to me, he asked me, well, do you know the artist Andy Goldsworthy, who I just love his environmental work, and he said, well, it's going to be sort of like that. I'm like, okay, great. I want to talk about it. I want to hear about it. I love the idea of, sort of artists going out in the environment and creating things with what they find there. Is that sort of the idea behind Test Fest?
Yeah, and, it's such a unique opportunity because earthwork and environmental work at its height was such an important movement in art, but I think it's become more important now. I mean, I think resources are limited financially, and I think the way that we deal with our environment is becoming more and more important as in another respect. And I was really excited about this, especially because there are very few opportunities to create this type of work. Most of our students grow up in a very urban setting, and although they have access to, green spaces, they're not spaces where they can just go install a piece of work or create something on site. The red tape to usually making something like this happen or even creating that kind of opportunity or space
is
usually
sort of legal
prohibitive.
Issues.
Exactly.
To go into a park and start like grabbing stuff and making stuff for it.
Absolutely.
Park rangers are going to come and go, what are you doing?
You just don't get this kind of opportunity where someone else has taken the steps in advance to get all the authorization necessary to get it cleared, to get it promoted. It's like a great present. It comes with all the trimmings included.
Now, this is going to take place at Skiles Test Nature Park on Fall Creek Road. Lori, I mean, you teach sculpture at DePauw. What I'm really curious about is how do you prepare for something like this, though? I mean, this is a totally sort of different type of project. Do you go to the park and sort of scope stuff out ahead of time? I mean, how do you? I know you're both creating piece and having your students do it. How do you prepare both yourself as an artist, but also how do you prepare your students for a project like this?
I'm fortunate at DePauw because they let me design my own curriculum, and I think Jim's Big Car, I think in the future I expect that DePauw will be able to develop some community ties with them. We have another faculty member now who's working on some community art classes and projects that are similar, and I'm teaching a class right now called Sculpture in Public Spaces. So again, it's really exciting to have students thinking about the environments that they come from and where their art will exist. But it's just very challenging, even on a small campus like DePauw. It really is challenging to give them those kind of opportunities. It takes 7 or 8 meetings just to arrange to put a bench somewhere. So I think in terms of preparing, like first I remind them what a great opportunity it is and make them feel excited, appropriately excited about it. But also, we try and get them inundated with this idea of working immediately in a site-specific manner or a site-sensitive manner. Taking advantage of all that they see and that they can take in, reminding them that there's conceptual approaches that they might take and that there's also formal or physical approaches that they might take. I'm trying to get them excited by looking at other artists who've worked this way is the biggest thing, because it's not likely that they're going to be able to plan their ideas out very much in advance.
Yeah, well, sort of what I was wondering. More sort of looking at different opportunities or influences, and then is the idea that you go into the park that day, obviously you're making work out of just the materials that are found there at the park, and so that's certainly going to influence what you have in mind. I'm wondering how much of it is a liability to go in with such a specific idea and realize, oh, the leaves I need are not here.
Right.
Or but also it's got to be kind of terrifying to go in and say, I have no idea what I'm going to make. I hope inspiration hits in the next 4 hours.
You did mention Andy Goldsworthy. He's a great earthwork type of artist. And one of the things I appreciate about him is that the work is gorgeous always, but it also almost never involves any. I mean, he literally goes out into the landscape with nothing but a pair of gloves and a little pair of clippers or something, you mm-hmm. know, so that these massive forms you see are just what they appear. They're stacked, you know, by they just subject to the gravity and the forces of the world, or they're pinned together with tiny twigs that he finds that he sort of weaves them together.
So I
he doesn't use any
adhesives.
There's no tools necessary. So that's an exciting inspirational source, mm-hmm. And it's just such a good experience for students to think about. You know, having immediate access to an audience, not having to work the way artists often work, which is sort of secluded away in a studio somewhere where they have time to develop ideas slowly mm-hmm. and to get a lot of feedback before it ever sees public eyes. You know, I think it's great for a community, too, to see artists working, you know, going through those stages, even if it's abbreviated in time.
Now, and there will be a lot of other artists working at the same time, right?
Yeah, we have 11 different people participating.
Okay.
And... 11 different projects. Mm-hmm. So there are multiple people on those, and then and that doesn't include the student groups. And then we're also working with the school up there, the elementary school that's nearby called Skylestest Elementary School. And we've already worked with them over there on some projects. And that day, any kids who come or adults who want to participate in Big Car's own project is going to be a collaborative one with anybody who wants to help out.
Well, that's what I was wondering. You know, if someone wants to come out to the Test Fest on the October 16th, it's going from 10 till 4, and wants to be a part of it, you know, do they need to get permission to go start pulling leaves off of a tree, or they should be actually collaborating with one of the other
groups?
We'll
have people there to kind of guide that through, and we'll have at least one or two teams who are working with visitors. Mm-hmm. All the artists are still going to be working that day.
Yeah.
So they can start, they can make some progress, but we want it to be an experience that's kind of like what we do down at Fountain Square every year at Masterpiece in a Day, where you can see mm-hmm. them painting or you can see them drawing typically. But I think this is a really great opportunity to open up people's eyes to different kinds of art that are still art but aren't painting or drawing. Mm-hmm. Something that if you were drawing out in the woods, it's not as connected to the materials that
mm-hmm.
this will be.
Right.
So
right.
I think this is a really good way for people to see another kind of art in action.
Well, it's interesting bringing up Masterpiece in a Day, because in some ways it kind of reminds me of that, you know, idea, you know, Saturday afternoon, you know, going out, you know, sort of doing stuff, but obviously, you know, sort of taking it even a step further. Masterpiece in a Day is a great event that the Big Car does. In fact, you guys just had that about a month ago or so. Why is it's so important for you, Jim, to... you know, help organize what essentially are community arts events? I mean, it's not always about, you know, the best art or the best artist, but the experience, it seems, is what you're really pushing all the time.
Sure. I mean, we've been down in our space in where we are in the Murphy Arts Center is a pretty exclusive spot. It's not fancy, and it's not a place just for rich people or anything like that, but it's exclusive in that access, everybody doesn't have access to it. And it's upstairs in any kind of a gallery or museum, right off the top, you take a lot of people out of the equation because access just isn't there for them. They don't feel comfortable. They don't know how to get to it. They've never heard of it. They just don't know where it is. And when we go out into neighborhoods where people are, then we're bringing the art to them instead of expecting them to come to us and sitting there and putting out flyers and posters and putting an ad in the paper and saying, hey, come on over here and see the art. Our idea is to go to them and go to the different neighborhoods and wide variety of neighborhoods. So, you know, Test Fest is up in Benford Boulevard, and then we're doing projects downtown, you know, on the east side, on the west side, Lafayette Square in November. And so it's a whole lot of different people who get to see art in their own neighborhood, and we want to make it easy for them to get to it.
Yeah, art as community building. That's
right.
Totally,
and then they come
purpose.
Together and connect with art and with the artists, and they're the artists sometimes.
Yeah.
And so then they connect with it and have a very positive experience with it.
Now, I know that the if you go to the made4.org, and that's MADE and then the number 4.org website, it's got a list of all the different Made For Each Other events going on in the different neighborhoods, so people can check that out and see what's going on close to them. Laurie, let me go back to you, though, a bit. As far as when you're talking to your students about work like this, certainly, you know, sculpture students, you know, working at a college, you know, are somewhat insulated from, you know, sort of art as, you know, neighborhood building or community building, that, you know, the type of work that Jim does. You know, how do you talk to them about that, or how do they respond to, you know, that idea of sort of, you know, taking art off the pedestal, so to speak?
It's pretty interesting because we spend so much time in an academic institution trying to teach students what the high end of art looks like and how to accomplish that and what it means and breaking it down and reading about it, looking at it, thinking about it. I suppose what happened, if there's a good thing that happened with a downturn in the economy, it's that resources are scarce and that we have to share them, you know, so that's the first thing, understanding that you're part of a wider community. And also that if you really want an arts community to develop, it starts, I mean, you know, it's like artichokes. You develop a taste for it. And if you're never exposed to it, then you never get a taste for it. So I suppose what I like for them to understand is that being an artist in a free world means that it comes with some obligations too, and part of it is you know, giving back in a literal sense, but also reminding yourself that if you want people to be grown-up adult supporters of art, you have to find them and help them to understand and to feel a part of it and to feel engaged by it when they're young, and then it's like then you have a taste for it and you seek it out as an adult, and your taste will get refined, and then you'll end up in those galleries that are a little more off-putting at first.
Yeah, so, I mean, the work that you're doing, Jim, is not just, you know, letting people experience art, but also building audiences.
Yeah, just last week we were over, and we're doing a project in the Near West neighborhood, Hawville, Hawthorne, and that area over there. And we went to a community picnic, and we had a table set up, and we're doing what we're calling collaborative creature collages, and people are making creatures out of collage material, and then we fold the page over, and there's a hand or a tail or a part of one creature that reaches over to the other side, and then someone else makes it on the other side, and then it connects at that crease, and then we unfold it, and we're doing a show of all these collaborative. And that neighborhood has such a good variety of people from different backgrounds and ethnicities, and we were over there doing that project. And we've also done a collage party at VidCar that was very similar, but it was a lot more people from the arts community who came, and they collaborated, and they made collages, and we did a big show of all of it. But when we were over there on the west side, we had people come over to us, kids and adults both, who didn't know what collages were and hadn't been exposed to those before.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And so we're explaining what a collage is, giving them scissors, and we have little kids who don't know how to use scissors very well, and we're helping them with scissors and giving them glue sticks and scissors, and they're cutting out things and making these different things. And it, you know, they were really excited to be making art, and they're out in Hawville Park. Mm-hmm. It's a beautiful day. They're outside, and they're making art together, and it's all going to be in an art show that we're putting on. And I think I like both things. I like connecting with the arts community that appreciates what we're doing and knows about all of it and appreciates it, knows who Andy Goldsworthy is and, you know, Max Ernst and people who make collages, and then other people who don't yet know about it. And maybe later they will, and maybe they'll be part of the arts community going forward, and they'll come down to VidCar and Fountain Square, or they'll go to the IMA or whatever, you know, go to the symphony. And I think that this is, I think we're kind of like a feeder program that's kind of help bring more people into the arts when they can afford it and when it's accessible to them.
Travis DiNicola with VidCar's Community Art Coordinator Jim Walker and Lori Miles, an art professor from DePauw. For more information about the Made for Each Other project, visit madefor.org, that's M-A-D-E, the numeral 4.org, or visit bigcar.org. So madefor.org or bigcar.org. Hey, Travis.
Yes, Sharon.
Before we send people out to do things in the arts today, we have an important reminder for them.
That's right. It is that time of year when we ask you to give us a call, give us an email, go online, and join WFYI. It's a perfect time to do it.
It absolutely is. Pledge your new support, renew your membership, give an additional gift. Do it now.
Do it now. And you can call 1-800-233-0020
or go online at
wfyi.org. That's right.
It's teamwork.
It is, just like the calendar that
you
we
and
do
the art of the matter.
Called What Do We Do
besides,
After We Pledge?
Besides Pledge. That's
besides
right.
Pledge, there you go.
I have some whimsical things that you can do. It's not just for kids, it's Holes on Stage at the IRT deals with a lost treasure and a multi-generational curse, racial injustice, and a strange correctional facility in the desert where kids serve time digging holes. If you haven't read the book or seen the movie, or maybe even if you have, go check check it out on stage with people of various ages in your family at the IRT.
Very cool. There was so much going on last weekend in the arts. Just wanted to let you know, if you've not heard already, that the 2010 Indiana Authors Awards were given out last Saturday night, and Scott Russell Sanders was the national winner, but the regional author, the winner of that, is Ray Boomhauer, and congratulations to him, and the emerging author, Greg Schwipps, for his work. So congratulations to all the winners and all the finalists and participants in the Indiana Authors Award that has been created by the Library Foundation. Really great event that they had held.
And the Indianapolis Opera is presenting us this weekend with The Mikado, the stories of Coco, Yum Yum, Nanki Poo, and the Mikado of Japan, and as they say, many, many more. If you've never heard it live, if you've only heard excerpts on the radio, now's the time. You can see the remaining performance this Sunday at 2 o'clock at Cruz Memorial Hall, The Mikado, Great Gilbert and Sullivan Classic.
That'll be a ton of fun. Mm-hmm. Yeah, really great, great opera. Hey, the Cultural Trail is having another ribbon cutting. In fact, that's coming up on November 5th. They're going to be opening up the Northeast Corridor. That's the corridor that goes around Mass Avenue and North and Alabama Streets and connects up to 10th Street. But before that, something pretty cool going on this Tuesday, the 19th, is Fred Wilson, who's an artist who's creating a public art project proposal for the Cultural Trail, is going to be doing a sort of question and answer and giving a public presentation at the Madam Walker Theater. It is free. It's at 6 p.m. And you can listen to Wilson describe the artistic practice that earned him one of the very cool MacArthur Genius Fellowships, and also learn about the project that he's proposed for the Cultural Trail. So again, that's free at the Madam Walker Tuesday night, 6 p.m.
Love that. This coming Thursday at 5:30 at Indie Fringe, it's Brew Books and Fringe Happy Hour. Our friend Rita Cohn has written a book called True Brew, which is a guide to Indiana craft beer. And at Brew Books and Fringe, you can yeah, it's easy for me to say. I need some beer apparently, or some books, or some fringe. But you can taste some beer. There's some food available. You can hear live music, and you can talk to Rita about her journey through Indiana, finding out all about craft brewers.
Excellent. Yeah, great book that she's put together. Mm-hmm. Hey, last thing I want to mention is, if you haven't been there yet, run, don't walk, to the Warhol exhibit at the IMA. Very, very cool. Definitely worth seeing. We're really fortunate to have an exhibit like that here in Indianapolis. Check it out.
Absolutely. A lot of fun. A lot of fun.
Okay.
You know, there's so much more going on, but we are out of time. So tune in again next week after you've pledged, of course.
That's right.
For more events on our calendar we call
What Do We Do?
You're listening to The Art of the Matter, a weekly show about the arts in Indianapolis and Central Indiana. Your hosts are Sharon Gamble and Travis DiNicola. If your arts organization has an event or activity of which you think we should be aware, please contact us at least 3 weeks in advance. You can write us at The Art of the Matter, care of WFYI, 1630 North Meridian Street, Indianapolis, Indiana, 46202. Or you can email us at artofthematter@wfyi.org. You can also hear The Art of the Matter on WFYI.org.
Rusty Moe decided to write a journal documenting his 60th year, and the result is a spiritual memoir, a wide-reaching journey, and a wild dance celebrating the joy of language. Rusty stopped in with his longtime partner Tim Hoover to talk about why he wrote the book called Bright Wildstone, a contemplative journal of roots that shape a life. Sharon Gamble learned more.
I want, in this journal of my 60th year, to lay bare my own gospel to myself, to wander back over the arc of my life among memories and notions, and perhaps glimpse and finger the slender threads that Robert Johnson writes of being in a particular place at just the right time, meeting someone who steers you in an unforeseen direction, the unexpected appearance of work or inspiration just when they're most needed, the patterns that bring coherence and continuity. Not a summing up, too early, or who knows, too late, nor a life has taught me manifesto, too pretentious, nor an if I knew then what I know now lament, too corny. I've always been a vocator, following a call from some place to no place, wandering from nowhere to right now and back to maybe. I've never figured out any direct route to any place special, so I'm not troubled by the promise of a destination, and I was never brainy enough to unriddle the big mysteries or to be concerned with what others get so head up about. So I decided a while back to be purely grateful for my life and to live it as out loud as I can. I've been born, I'm seeing and doing and offering what I can, I'll pass. I've become less interested in the wide world, in knowing a lot about a lot of things, in retaining what I've been assured are facts or truths or reality. The noise inside me is shrinking. I want to stay still in one place and listen to it, and learn about my place in it, and about the souls of the few people here that I can in no way imagine myself without.
It feels to me as though the call of this journal has maybe occurred to you before this year when you wrote
What was the word?
The call. The inspiration, the lure. Maybe you waited for the right time.
This started out as a novel 10 years ago.
Really?
Yes. I had it in my mind to write a coming-of-age story. Mm-hmm. And I think it was about 10 years. And my imagination wasn't working in that direction. And one day, I put two things together. My partner, Tim Hoover, said that he liked the emails that I wrote about home, telling about the dogs, the light in the rooms, just the homey stuff. And then I remember I did another master's in creative writing from Butler in the 90s, and Susan Neville said she liked my Michigan stories. So those were the ones that always lit up for her. I took several classes from her. And somehow there was something about the morning, the light, the Tim saying that the emails worked for him, the Michigan stories. All of a sudden I realized I was writing my own story by writing this novel. And I put it together with, I love journals. They're my favorite form of writing. I love Mae Sarton, Thomas Merton, other writers who write about the creative process. So I, it somehow just went, I started putting some stuff down on paper, and I lit up. And what, it was about a year and a half later, this was published. So it was a novel. And it was Bright Wild Stone. I had the title long before I even started writing the book. This is my fourth book. I've had the titles before I've written them. I've written for the title, I guess you might say.
And how did the title come to you?
I thought I was being so smart. I just liked the sound of Bright Wild Stone. So I just wrote that down. That kind of helped me collect some thoughts around that vision, that image. And then after I was way into writing this book, I found the quote from Revelation, which opens the book. I am giving you a stone, the book of Revelation, that is, in the Christian Bible. I'm giving you a stone. On it is written your true name, a name that no one but you will know. So I found that. Then I was reading a book by Alice Walker about a myth in African literature that children are born with stones in their mouths, and that stone is taken out, and on that stone is their destiny. So I thought, well, this is in the collective unconscious.
Right, it must
it's
be.
It's moving
for
through
it to
us
have
all.
Because
I'm just, you know, I wasn't thinking consciously of any of this. So there's also a saint in Irish literature, spirituality. I forget his name. But he was born with a stone in his mouth that healed people. So, and I found that later.
Don't stop looking. More will
come
to you.
I know. I'm just going to. So there. That's how the title came to me. It came to me.
Keeping a journal is one thing.
Mm-hmm.
Keeping a journal when you have someone at home very close to you is another. Tim, did you ever worry in this year? Did you ever have a conversation where you said to each other, "Now stop! Don't you dare put that in your journal."
No, never.
You weren't
had
worried.
Anything like that? No, I just totally. If Rusty's going to write something, if it's about us, I totally trust it.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we're pretty open books anyway, so I don't think there's anything to hide.
You've been together a long time.
21 years.
Yeah.
I think. Was there anything in it, though, that surprised you after it came out, or a reaction? I'm doing your job, aren't I?
No, I love this.
Okay,
that's
okay.
I was going to ask that.
Oh, okay.
But, wow.
I've never asked you that.
No, and I'm totally unprepared.
Free therapy on the air.
Totally unprepared
this.
For that.
Nothing's embarrassed you, though, has it?
No. Oh, no.
Or,
uh-uh.
So maybe that's what I mean by surprise.
No, nothing's embarrassed me. It's I just love the fact that you have you've written, and because I think you use words so well and express, as I've told you many times in your poetry, things that other people think but they've never put into words, and that's really what I see in Rusty's writing. Why I've loved his writing from the first time I ever read anything that he wrote, because I just relate to it.
Yeah.
There is, and know that I mean this as a compliment, a Ulysses-like quality in the cataloging of the great and the small and the painful. I mean, anybody who's never had a kidney stone could read this and know what horror it is, what torture it is.
Hmm.
But then the mundane, the quotidian joys
every day
of waiting for the birds to find the place for the new bird feeder.
Right. Well, I was just thinking, I know you're arts and crafts woman, aren't you?
Mm-hmm.
And I was reading something that William Morris said, that somebody asked him about happiness, and he said that happiness for him was paying attention to the details of everyday life that led him into happiness. And I thought, well, that's what this is for
me.
It's just I like your word cataloging. You know, I think that's what I did, and it's a very plain book. I think it's very ordinary, the things I talk about. But I loved finding juicy words to say, plain things quietly, maybe in a beautiful way without sounding conceited, if I can do that.
No, of course, that's part of your mission as a writer. Mm-hmm. It strikes me you've also, through this book and maybe in your life in general, become kind of a curator of stories of survival.
Yeah.
There are, as I kept reading, I thought, there are a couple who survive the sinking of the Titanic only to have a sad end to their romance.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
A young serviceman who survived an attack on a boat during the war, who survived because...
Mm-hmm. The USAT Dorchester, yes.
Right, because a rabbi gave him his own life jacket. Mm-hmm. You yourself survived because you started to step out into traffic to end it all when you were just a little boy.
Yeah, I just...
And your father yanked you back and said, what are you doing?
From in front of the Mack truck. Yeah, I didn't want to be here. It was just too... It was too tense of a time for a spirit as sensitive as mine, as I look back on it. I'm glad the truck didn't have its way with me, you know, in a way. But it didn't, so here I am, and I'm trying to make sense of that. Yeah, all of this has been the journey to make meaning of my own story, which isn't too different, I don't believe, from other people's stories. I think circumstances are different, but sometimes meaning and the meaning we make of things hold us here in meaning, in hold us here together in hopefully good ways.
You know, that makes good sense. I have a question about you carry out multiple roles in the world, as do we all, but in particular...
Yeah, look who's talking.
You're a therapist, you're a writer, you lead workshops. Those are all three different roles.
Mm-hmm.
How do those coexist? Where's the writer when you're guiding someone in a therapy session?
That's neat. I think they coexist through the, don't know if this is the right word, through the motion of attention. I think they all connect in me through the attention that I pay to people.
Mm-hmm.
To the words that I want to use when I'm expressing myself. And I also, in my work as a therapist, and I also do supervise students in the counseling program at Christian Theological Seminary, and paying attention to the students and the words they use about their clients and the words that my own clients use. I think it's attention. There's a quality of attention that I trust that I kind of, these words all sound so large, that I surrender to, in a sense, that carry me, carry the relationship with others. So I think that's where I would say I connect. There's also something about attention, but around that attention is a silence. There's a silence that holds us to, this is too metaphysical, Sharon.
Don't stop. You're getting
there. I think I'm done.
And I realized I've left off a very important role, which is you're a muse to Tim's music, I imagine.
I am?
Yeah.
Am I your muse?
Well,
I think. Well,
I'd never done that CD. I'd never gone out and singing at all. I don't think without your encouragement.
Sharon Gamble spoke with Rusty Moe and Tim Hoover. You can find out more and order Rusty's book, Bright Wild Stone: A Contemplative Journal of Roots That Shape a Life, at fourthloydproductions.com. That's fourth, F-O-U-R-T-H, Lloyd, L-L-O-Y-D, productions.com. And here's a bit of Tim's work, Orange Colored Sky, from his CD, Street of Dreams. You can find the CD at cduniverse.com. Again, cduniverse.com.
I was walking along, minding my business, when out of an orange colored sky, flash, bam, alakazam, wonderful you walked by. I was humming a tune, drinking in sunshine, went out of that orange-colored view. Flash, bam, alakazam, I got a look at you. One look and I yelled timber.
Thanks for joining us today. The music for today's show is courtesy of the Vaselli Wallrap Jazz Orchestra from their Heart and Soul album, available through Owl Studios at owlstudios.com.
Please listen to The Art of the Matter again next Friday at 8 and Saturday at 4. I'll take a look at Madeleine Albright's pin collection.
Wow. I'll talk with artist Walter Knobby about the time that he spent working for Andy Warhol.
And I'll get a preview of what's coming up at the Indiana History Center. Plus, there's our arts calendar week all.
What'll we do? So please listen next Friday at 8 and Saturday at 4 for The Art of the Matter here on WFYI for your information.
You've been listening to The Art of the Matter, made possible by the ongoing support from listeners like you, and from the Palladium at the Center for the Performing Arts, opening in January 2011. The Art of the Matter. Your hosts are Sharon Gamble and Travis DiNicola. Today's Art of the Matter was produced and edited by Travis DiNicola. The Art of the Matter on 90.1 FM, Indianapolis.